Welcome to Sober Dad Crew, the podcast where we talk about all things sobriety, recovery, parenting, music, tattoos, work, and more. For more information, please visit SoberDadCrew.com. My guest this episode is Beth Shelton. Beth is the Chief Executive Officer of Girl Scouts of Greater Iowa, overseeing all operations for 13,000 members in portions of Iowa, Nebraska, and South Dakota. She's given hundreds of speeches, conference talks, podcast interviews, and has reached millions of people on topics ranging from workplace transformation to mental well-being and sobriety. Beth, welcome to Sober Dad Crew.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be on today.
Yeah, and I should say congratulations because you are now officially a remarkable woman.
Thank you so much. Right. Yes,
like there was a trophy or something.
Yeah, definitely. I should have demanded a trophy. I like that idea.
Yeah, I don't know if everyone gets a trophy. We had a big debate in my house recently about school theater and if all like high school theater should get a standing ovation. I don't know. It was a bit of a friendly yet heated topic.
I could see both sides of that. That'd be an interesting argument to listen into because I'm not sure where I stand on that.
I think I was on the losing side of it, but my wife is pretty amazing, so I usually end up agreeing with her. In the end, she's a social worker, so I feel like she's got her pulse on the things that are good.
Okay, let me speculate. You were on the side of, no, they don't all deserve a standing ovation, that they need to earn it so that it means something. And otherwise, it's diluted if there's always a standing ovation. And she was on the side of, but everyone needs to feel valued and seen and heard and celebrated for what they get out there and did, regardless of how it was interpreted.
Yeah, so mine was the most white man response position,
okay.
I think, in the end, which is a position in life I try and avoid as much as possible.
Sure.
But yeah, I think in the end, I was probably wrong in my position. And you were right on which sides of the debate that was on.
Yeah, it's an interesting debate. I did not get a trophy yesterday, but I did feel very honored and receive a great honor. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, and it's a bit of a dovetail, and I don't remember how I connected with you on LinkedIn. You know, you're pretty public, but then somewhat recently you posted about a year of sobriety, and I thought I've got to talk to Beth because she's kind of the person that nobody looks at and says, that person has an unhealthy relationship with alcohol.
Yeah, it's I first took to, so I think the post you might be referring to, it was actually on 900 days. So you're right, it was kind of a milestone for me. But I started writing about my relationship with alcohol on my 6-month anniversary of being dry, of being sober, and which was now right about 2 years ago. And I had this moment of, I'm very introverted in real life, even though I have a very public facing role and job and do public speaking, I'm really introverted.
Yeah, and I'm totally like that. I get it.
Yeah. Okay. So to talk about really deeply intimate things, I sometimes prefer writing. So on my 6-month anniversary, I wrote about being sober for 6 months. It was the first time I had really put pen to paper, so to speak. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is too vulnerable to post on Facebook where I know everyone. These are my neighbors and my friends. And I was like, you know what? I just kind of randomly posted it on LinkedIn because I'm like, well, I don't really, those aren't my neighbors, right? This doesn't feel real. And that post went viral with more than 2 million views and interactions and comments and thousands of messages. And I was like, well, you can't put that toothpaste back in the tube.
Yeah.
Like that is, oh, no, okay, now we're out, you know? And so then that sort of accidentally became my journey of starting to talk publicly about my unhealthy relationship with alcohol and what it was doing to my life. And I think it added another layer of accountability for me because now I was really out about being sober as well. It was scary to talk about though. There are some topics where it's like, oh, it's so great to be vulnerable and people celebrate those topics. And some topics that still kind of get the eyebrow raise. And I absolutely feel like addiction is in the eyebrow raise category from my public, you know, my feeling of being in a public role. That's my perception of how the response can sometimes, you know, be felt.
Yeah. And I feel like it's very complicated in the workplace. I've certainly had some jobs where even when, you know, it was public that I didn't drink, it was known I didn't drink, and but I didn't really define it as sobriety at that point. I just sort of said, yeah, I don't drink. And then later I was more out about the experiences and what happened and why I got there. But there are definitely some people who kind of held that against me. They questioned it. And it is scary when you're trying to build a career. At that time I was a single parent and I was kind of trying to build back up. And I had this sort of fear during those years of, there's no one else. If I lose this job, if something happens, there's no other income. There's no backup plan. It's just me. And, you know, there just did come a point when I said, you know, people don't look at me now and think this is someone who struggled. And people struggle, right? With tons of stuff. It doesn't have to be alcohol. There's a lot of trauma out there that people experience. And we need to like embrace that that's a thing and that people can heal, right? And there's a journey to that. So, you know, I applaud those kind of public posts. It's this thing I've come up with called LinkedIn versus life, right? Like we all got the headshot, right? But like, what is it behind the headshot?
Absolutely. It takes a lot of courage to talk about sobriety and write about sobriety when you are thinking about your career. And like you, I had a lot of fear around that. You know, I had gone through a difficult divorce as part of that year or two where I was really shouldering all those heavy things in life and leaning on alcohol. And like you, I sort of tiptoed into the language early on. I danced around, I'm alcohol free or I'm living dry. And I didn't want to say the word sober because had an implication in my mind that, oh, that person must be an addict or have a problem or there must be issues, that somehow that very word or alcoholic, you know, those were words that I steered away, steered clear from early on because I was worried about the label and the stigma. And I've gotten much more courageous about being authentic about what I am, what I was, and what I am, which is I was an alcoholic and I'm sober.
Yeah. Can you give a little more information on that? Do you do a program or, you know, kind of were you a slippery slope person or did the partying kind of never stop? Kind of your journey with that? Like, when did it take the turn where you're like, oh yeah, this is not working?
Mm-hmm. It was not a clearly defined line. I think I danced around at least for a year with, do I have a problem? Do I have a problem? And so the journey for me was, it wasn't a problem until it was a problem. And I don't know exactly where that line is. It's not very clear. And we are sort of taught, there's a lot of information we get in society that will tell you don't have a problem or that it's a relative scale. So as long as I am not, you know, at rock bottom, as long as I'm not doing this life altering thing, then I must not have a problem. And so I told myself all of those stories for a long time. What I would say is where I really noticed a tremendous difference is in 2020, life got exponentially harder in a lot of ways for me and for a lot of people. And so all of a sudden I was working remotely in this very big job, trying to lead through a crisis. You know, I'm a CEO of a large nonprofit and, you know, we have 60 employees and regional offices everywhere. We were not equipped like most people to work fully remote. And additionally, I was going through a difficult divorce and had 3 kids at home who were, you know, the school sent them home for spring break and then wouldn't take them back.
Yeah,
and
March all of a 13th. Sudden, I remember right. That day.
Yeah. So it was like I had the weight of the world on my shoulders and what I have learned a lot about what I was tying my identity to, which was a lot of external things, you know, a lot of components of my job and public speaking. And I didn't realize how much of my identity was tied up in all of that until my identity became, I'm in these 4 walls in this difficult position, this difficult role, this difficult relationship, parenting. And I felt like I lost my identity. And so I was dealing with all these hard operational things and then all this hard inside stuff. And my access to alcohol got a lot easier because I was working remotely and a lot of people were at the time were doing Zoom happy hours. And so eventually it started became more and more and more frequent earlier in the day. You know, I heard a description one day that, you know, addiction is the narrowing of things that bring you happiness. And I absolutely found myself every single day of course, it became a 7-day-a-week job to make sure I got alcohol. But I found myself thinking, like, when can I get it? And if I'm going to go to this event, how can I make sure I have access to it? So it became the beacon that I at least emotionally centered myself around. I thought I was doing a good job of hiding it from other people. I was still high functioning, still volunteering, still working out, still reading books. Like, from the outside, what I hear people say today is, you don't look like you had a problem. And I didn't know you had a problem. So just because I was good at hiding it didn't mean it wasn't a huge problem for me. Probably the biggest catalyst moment after a year of living that way, which was clearly not making me happier and not making me healthier. My kids, I have 3 children. 2 of them were teenagers at the time. The other one is younger. And they came to me with a list. And on the list, this was in late 2020, it said 10 ways you can be a better mom. And that was gut-wrenching. It felt like a gut punch. And not the kind of list
I want to fucking avoid that list.
Right? I was very defensive. I was very hurt. You know, I'm like, oh, these kids today, they don't understand. They don't know what it's like, how hard I try, how much I love them. On, you know, my defensiveness went on and on. And here's, you know, a really important thing I've learned in life. The more defensive I feel, I have to pause and think, what chord is that strumming in me? Why do I feel so defensive about this thing? Because some of the things on their list had some merit. Some of them were pretty ridiculous. The ridiculous ones didn't trigger me in a defensive way. It was the ones that had merit that triggered me in a defensive way. And one of the things on the list is they said, Mom, we wish you would stop drinking alcohol. And I didn't even realize they had noticed that I had a problem, that I was drinking so much. So that was my first wake-up call. Like, I can't believe they noticed. I can't believe they don't understand this. Over the course of the next year then, I tried 17 times to stop drinking, all the variety of, I can do this. I'm a very, you know, accomplished person, and I was a college athlete, and I have, you know, a strong will. And I just kept thinking, if I can just willpower my way through this, like, why can't I? Because I can willpower my way through a lot of other things. And I wasn't even recognizing that I had a full addiction. And I also wasn't recognizing that my resilience bucket and my willpower bucket was empty. I mean, life was so difficult that there's a finite amount of that stuff to pull from, and I had none left to pull from. So time after time, I would do that. I can stop. I can do this. Go 3 or 4 days, maybe. My longest duration at that time was 36 days. And then I would drink, and I would convince myself of all, I'd have the internal dialogue. I don't need to stop. It's not that bad. You know, all those things. I would then drink. I would then regret it, and I'd get into the shame spiral, and then I would start the counter over. And on my 18th try, that's the one I'm on right now, which is about 920 days. So just about 2.5 years. And I have found a lot of success now. I think you asked a little bit about like the tools, you know?
Yeah. Like what, you know, what stuck, you know, why is number 18 the number? Cause I think, you know, I was fortunate and I just stopped. I caught myself at the right time. And didn't really look back, but I've talked to a lot of other people where they try. And then, you know, what for you was that thing that kind of worked this time?
Yeah, I had been, of course, dabbling at that time for about a year with trying to stop. And so I had educated myself. I was listening to a lot of podcasts about, you know, living alcohol free and being sober. I was reading a lot of books. I had a great therapist. You know, I had just gone through a divorce and through this, you know, pandemic era of leadership. And so I was meeting with him at one point weekly. And I got to a place, I think 2 big things happened. Number one, I had a lot of suicidal ideation. I had hit that point in life where I felt despair and that I was losing hope. And I didn't correlate that perhaps it's because I'm drinking 7 days a week, right? I couldn't make that correlation at the time, but I sat with my therapist one day and I said, just please, I mean, I was in utter despair. I said, please help me know how I can take my own life without hurting my kids. And he said, Beth, I think you know you can't do that. Let's work on creating a life you don't want to escape from. And it hadn't really occurred to me that that was a choice, that I could make active choices to not want to escape my life. And I hadn't really correlated that I was escaping my life by drinking alcohol every day, that that's what I was doing. And I knew that I had a beautiful life. I have healthy, beautiful, amazing children that I love more than anything. I'm privileged to have a great job I love. Like, I have my health. I have so much to be grateful for, and yet I just couldn't quite make that correlation. So I think that was the first thing that I felt like it was just a light bulb moment, him saying that, to create a life I don't want to escape from and to start taking steps to do that. There's no question. The other big factor is the ecosystem I was living in did get objectively a little less stressful. I mean, you know, by this time, some of the pandemic era difficulties were lightening up a little bit in terms of leadership and workforce and how we operate and how we raise money and do all the things at work. The divorce was final and I was settling into my new life and what that looked like. So some of the really big stressors that I was escaping had calmed down a little bit. And also I felt like I had the tools and advice to take a path, a step forward. The last time I drank, on time number 17, I want to tell you, it was my daughter's, I think, 16th birthday. And I remember making sure that we had her party somewhere that served alcohol. It was a kind of family center that has a lot of activities, but they also have a bar. And I made sure that we picked a place that had alcohol. And I had just two beers that night. And I felt so proud, like, that's not bad. No one even notices. I'm not any different. And then I had to start the counter over. And the next morning, I felt such remorse. Like, why would I ever want to soften the edges of my daughter's 16th birthday? Like, what? Why would I want to ever numb any part of that experience? And I felt a lot of shame. And this was on after 17. And I was like, okay, that's, man, I'm not going to do that again. And 2 days later, I drank again. I was at a community golf outing. I told my friend I was riding with that morning. It was an 8 a.m. shotgun start. And I said, look, I'm not, you know what? I'm not drinking right now. You know, I was kind of vague in my language. By the second hole, I had cracked my first beer, as everyone had, right? That was the norm. That's what you do on golf courses. And that was the last time I drank. That was on September 10th. And then the next morning I woke up with shame and regret. And I'm like, I don't want to do that again after 18 tries of going through that. But I think the birthday moment, onto the 17th try, was really, it really stuck with me because it involved my kids. And when I think about missing out on anything, softening the edges of anything, you know, I've heard maybe sort of an internet meme that says, like, you say you're willing to die for your kids, but it's a lot braver and harder to truly show up and live for your kids. And I was like, oh, ouch. Is that what I'm doing? You know?
Yeah. You know, and as a parent, so I've got four now, you know, my son will be 21 in July. My daughter will be 17 next month. And then I have almost 8-year-old stepkid, stepson, and a 12-year-old stepdaughter who, they really aren't my stepkids. Like, they're just 100% my kids. And I wouldn't know my wife if I weren't sober. Like, we met in the pandemic, which took insane levels of intentionality. Like, the first kiss in a pandemic is like a different thing because you're like, oh, right. Our bubbles, like, this is our bubbles literally intersecting because we just went for walks. You know, we right. FaceTimed a ton and we hung out outside. I mean, it was interesting time to meet, but we're both sober and we definitely would not have been together or worked in another time. You know, absolutely. So it's a lot of what I tell people too. There's always light at the end of the tunnel. It might not seem super bright, you know, and I mm-hmm. think that's what's hard for people, but like there is hope and there is a way. Now, do you do a program or do you just sort of stick with the therapist? I just did the therapist thing and that really helped me.
I just stick with the therapist as well. I'm a big advocate of programs. I have, you know, I like to say I have visited a program from the parking lot because as an introvert, I would pull in a couple times thinking maybe I need to visit this program. And I was too, all the things, afraid, shy, uncertain to walk through the doors. So I hadn't ever formally visited a program. I have since visited several times with people I know, sat in the back row, you know, three or four times. And I see a lot of value for those people and the community that they have and the level of understanding they get from people, being able to pick up the phone and call someone who understands when you feel like you're on thin ice or white knuckling it in a moment. So I think there's a lot of value there, but that just happened not to have been my path.
Yeah. I want to touch upon this because I think we skirted over it, that we're both of a similar temperament in that we're, I call myself reserved, introvert, reserved, but we have pretty public jobs. I mean, a lot of my job, I'm at my desk, but I direct marketing and business development for an architecture firm. We got three offices in New York. I go to conferences, and conferences are, A, they're one of those places there's a lot of alcohol. B, yes. It's like, for me, I'm like, okay, I got to like find this other side of Steven that is like, where's the outgoing guy? I got to like muscle it a little bit. You know, it's like the end of a run where you're like, yes, I'm like really right. tired, but like another 1K to go. So it's interesting to sort of be in those worlds that don't really feel like they fit your authentic self.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And probably like you, there were times alcohol felt like a really handy crutch, being someone who's reserved or introverted, particularly at networking events, at conferences, where it's the norm. And, you know, what I hear people say is, well, everyone, you know, everyone feels a little bit that way, a little bit uncertain in networking, and alcohol makes everyone feel that way. But I had to really learn, who am I without this crutch, and how do I get a little bit more intentional? Because natural Beth is not out there networking or talking to people in that way. And so I had to relearn, you know, it really, sobriety revealed all new layers of myself. And it also revealed layers in other people, because I no longer had that filter of the people I was experiencing. And they revealed themselves in new and different ways. So it's almost like a rebirth, really, to sound kind of cliche, in so many different ways about how I experience the world and how I experience myself and how I have to show up in different ways.
Yeah. Side networking tip is, I figured out, have a networking buddy.
Oh, I like that.
So like, yes. I was on the board of the Hangar Theater in Ithaca. So I would do those events with the executive director, because we were in different, like our day jobs were different, but we knew each other. And you then avoid that horrible, awkward standing there trying to like get into this sort of closed circle of people. It's just so awkward. It's just like, and the other thing I did at conferences is, if I was alone, like at breakfast, I'd pick an empty table and I just sit, yes. and I would let the universe pack that table with people around me and just sort of see what happens, see who I'd sit next to. You meet definitely more interesting people that way, because you're not kind of prescribing it. And I felt like if there's someone else like me that's really awkward, they might appreciate this easier. Like, I don't have to try and take the last seat and, oh, is somebody mm-hmm. actually sitting there? Yeah, right. Networking.
Absolutely. Well, I would be that person to go sit with the person sitting by themselves. And I would probably sit like three seats away, and I would still probably be like, is this seat taken?
Right. You
know, like, it's clear that it's not taken,
yeah.
But just kind of the uncertainty in that moment. I heard a term in my sobriety journey that I have leaned on so much, and it's called the relapse prevention plan. And I use it now in a multitude of ways beyond alcohol. I use it if I'm thinking about eating sugar-free for a month or whatnot, but it's about identifying those high-risk situations ahead of time and how I'm going to deal with them. So at first, everything was a high-risk situation, but networking would be a high-risk situation. Why? Because I leaned on alcohol for X, Y, and Z. Okay, I know that, name it, and then go in with an alternate plan. In your case, okay, my plan is to sit at this different table, or my plan is to not go to this outing, you know, and I had to break really strong associations. I associated a warm patio with drinking a cold beer. I associated boating with a beer. I associated golfing with a beer. I associated great food with red wine. So I had to break these associations and learn, relearn how to experience those things fully. And I also, you know, one note about networking, I told myself a story that it helped me to have a glass of alcohol, a glass of red wine. And it might have softened my experience in that moment, but it did not help me. It did not make me a better listener. It did not make me more funny. And those are sort of lies that the alcohol was telling
right.
me. But as I got sober, and as I see other people do it, when there's alcohol involved, it's not making them better listeners. It's not making them better friends often, right? This is a generalization. It's not making them funnier. And yet that's the story we tell ourselves when we're drinking it. And so getting objective about some of that stuff was helpful for me as well. That's sort of a lie that I was believing, that it was helpful for networking. And actually, no, I don't think it was.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Probably also didn't improve your golf game.
No, of course not. And of course, I told myself it did, right? Like, oh, I'm at cruising altitude and two beers gives me a better putt. And that's not true. It's not true.
Maybe you know? Just care less about the results of the putt.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm not a golfer, so I confess to not understanding golf. I schedule people for a lot of golf at work, though. Not my favorite part of my job, coming up with the foursomes.
Absolutely. I'm sure. I'm not going to stereotype everyone that's golfing, but I will say it is a common practice for people to drink alcohol all day long on the golf course. And it's something that drew me to golf because it was socially acceptable by 10 a.m. for people to be having, whether it was a Bloody Mary or a beer or whatnot. That's part of the culture. Again, I'm not saying that's why everyone golfs, but I will say, I think that there we find a way to get attracted to these activities where we can justify drinking. And I had to really get honest with myself about what kind of activities was I doing as a justification for drinking alcohol. And I still love to golf today, but I had to break that narrative for myself. And I absolutely used it as an excuse to drink.
Was that hard to break that the first time you got out on the golf course again?
Yes, I went in on try number, again, 17, sort of, you know, stumbles along the way. On number 18, I used a lot of planning and I had some trepidation. You know, it used to be that every time I would fly, I would stop at the airport bar. They knew me by my first name. I would have a beer. And then if I got the free upgrade, I would have a drink on the, and then the golf course and the patio, the boating, the fishing, whatever. And so I used a lot of caution, especially in that first year. I thought ahead of time. I didn't wait to see what it felt like in the moment. Like the 17th time I fell off the wagon at that golf event. I didn't wait to see. I planned ahead of time to say, how's this going to feel? What might people say? Who might I see? What excitement might I be feeling? What trepidation might I be feeling? I really tried to plan ahead for what I was going to be feeling and maybe sometimes plan ahead on what I bring with me. I have a regular meeting that I attend where alcohol is pretty present with most of the group. And I used to be one of the group and drinking that. And now I bring my own beverage of choice. And because there's limited other options at this venue. They don't cater to non-alcoholic drinks, really. So now I plan ahead and I bring my own drink with me. Okay. But it took some intentionality for all those firsts, you know. I literally would turn down free upgrades on airplanes that first year because I don't ever buy first class, but occasionally I would get moved up based on the number of miles I had or something, right? And I had to turn it, I would go up and say, I can't take this seat. Because when the flight attendant came to offer beverages, I didn't trust that I could say no, or that if the person next to me was drinking red wine, I can smell it across the aisle. And I would sit there and just think like, it's right there.
My dad did that after he quit smoking back in the day when they had smoking sections on the plane or smoking sections. And he would quit, but he would go sit like in the smoking section. That, you know, for the youngsters out there, they might not remember those days, but I remember those days. But you sacrificed leg room for your sobriety. That's like big, man. That's like super big.
I did. You know, I never forgot that moment with my therapist talking about ending my life and what that would mean for my kids. And I can sacrifice some leg room, you know, to make sure that I don't have to have those thoughts or that conversation again. Now, I don't have to turn down the free upgrades anymore. You know, if someone is sitting next to me with a glass of red wine on an airplane now, which has happened a few times, I sit with gratitude, you know, kind of twirling my Sprite, and I sit with gratitude and think it's beautiful that I don't need that. It's beautiful that I don't want it. And it's fine for them if they do. It's never from a place of judgment. Like, great. It's amazing for them that they can sit and have one glass of red wine on an airplane. If I could have had one, I wouldn't be in this seat of needing to remove it from my life.
Yeah. And it's not our job. And my wife will tell me we were in the grocery store and they had all the stuff set up for the eclipse, all the glasses, and there's a bunch of beer next to it. And I was like, oh, why is like everything, you know, linked to alcohol? She's like, you don't, it's not yours to worry that, you know, you don't, as she likes to say, keep your side of the street clean. And we say it to our kids and then we go, whoosh, 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 which they hate, but it's really true. It's like all you can do is keep your side of the street clean. Everybody else has got to deal with theirs. But if you're always out there worried about what's going on with everybody else, then certainly that's a big conversation with the teenagers that are in my house. It's easy to get, especially, and I don't want to like totally hate on social media or whatever, but it's so easy to get really wrapped up in everybody else's drama and business and sort of forget in a way that they're a person too and they're struggling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. To see, recognize there's human beings on the other side of that issue. I think my version of what you're saying is control the controllables. You know, the thing I can control, whether it's where I sit on an airplane or whatnot, you know, is, focus on that, because it's really a fruitless effort to sort of think outside of that with our emotions or, you know, things. So that's my version of that, is try to control the controllables.
That's like the corporate version of the Serenity Prayer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, it absolutely is. And it saves me a lot of angst at work. You know, just name what it is. Name the thing, like, okay, and, oh, here's this, you know, it used to be the hard thing would come at me. Let's go back to 2020. The hard thing would come at me. And then I'm like, you know, I'm reacting to the water around me. This is so stressful. And now I'm like, okay, and what are our options? That is, yeah, that is unfortunate. That is stressful. That is, you know, we are in a pickle on this issue, whatever it is. But, and what are we going to do about it? I don't need to spend a lot of, I call it, you know, my emotional color commentary. I don't need to spend a lot of time there. It's fruitless. I just go right to what are the solutions?
Yeah. Are you public at work about it? I mean, you're like head of Girl Scouts for all of Iowa. Is that what it is? Or more than Iowa? You're like the Girl Scout czar or something.
Yeah, the Girl Scout czar. That's right.
I've always wanted to be a czar. No one will call me czar.
Yeah, it's incredible. I gotta say, it lives up to its name for sure. I'm the CEO of Girl Scouts of Greater Iowa. I've been in the role for about 9 years, and it's about 2/3 of the state. It's roughly 70 counties. It's an arbitrary jurisdiction, but it's most of the state of Iowa. I am out at work again. I didn't really mean to be. I just sort of stumbled into it after that LinkedIn post went viral. We were still working remotely for the most part. A lot of people were, so I wasn't interacting a lot, you know, in person with people. But it started to slowly kind of creep into conversations. I would start to sort of acknowledge it. By my 1 year anniversary with sobriety, I again wrote about it on social media. This time I included Facebook. And then people really started to embrace that. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So now I am out about it at work. You know, it's not mine to worry about the other side of the street in terms of airplanes and things. But I think one area where I have started to show some intentionality about how could we move the needle? How could we be a good stewards of people that are facing addiction and things is trying to be intentional about workplace processes and practices, because even in a lot of workplaces, alcohol is really center. And even at mission-based nonprofits and at big fundraisers. And so really thinking through when we have activities and events for our staff, how are we being intentional about, you know, alternatives to alcohol, making sure it's not the center of everything. Sometimes when I do a lot of keynote speeches and public speeches. Sometimes I'll talk about my journey with sobriety and alcoholism and some things workplaces can do to acknowledge that. It's remarkable the number of events I go to where they don't have either one mocktail on the menu or one NA beer, you know, something besides you kind of have soda or water for the people that don't drink.
Which they put in a plastic cup for you, like you're five.
Right. And let me just add a whole other layer that females experience. I'm sure males get the question of like, oh, are you not drinking or why are you not drinking? Right. But females get the extra layer.
I know where you're going.
Are you pregnant? Are you, you know, like there's this like whispering, like it can, the only reasonable explanation.
Right. The only possibility.
Yeah. So it's this very personal topic regardless. And so to have it, you know, called out because there's no alternative on the menu. So I'm passionate about trying to make sure that A, we don't have alcohol as the center focus of our, even of our big fundraising events. It's very well known that fundraisers often have alcohol at them. You know, that's true even at big nonprofits, but the alcohol is not the center focus, and we have great alternatives, even if there is alcohol there. And those are, that's low hanging fruit. There's, you know, that's really easy to manage.
So many alternatives out there now. And you have, you know, right. What did you say? 60 staff. So it's pretty likely that there's at least one or two other people on your staff that struggle with some kind of substance abuse thing, or definitely are just struggling in other ways, right?
Like, right, with their mental well-being, question.
Maybe they've also have gotten divorced, which is like hard. And, you know, as someone who's like sort of come full circle with that and, you know, gotten married again, which has really been incredible. But it's really hard. And then, you know, there's a whole other world of like sober dating.
I interviewed
the woman who wrote this book, Dry Humping, which I do think is like the best book title ever. And it's all about like sober dating. And it's this really incredible book. She's very cool. But there's so much of all of life that actually can get wound up into alcohol. My wife and I went to a show 2 weeks ago. This guy, Dave Hawes, who I like and I've interviewed on here, and they had an NA menu. You had to ask for it, though. It was weird to me that you went through the trouble of having like 8 NA beers and 6 mocktails, and then you just didn't give people the thing. Because another guy interviewed who owns a bar in Chicago said his NA sales in the last year have grown 600%. Like, tell me, as someone in business development, how I can grow something 600% and I will be the hero of the day. I mean, of course, it means he's selling less, you know, of alcohol drinks there, but he's created an environment that's more welcoming to a wide variety of people. Like, I can go to a bar. It doesn't bother me. I love going to see music. It's not a big deal, but not everybody is in that position. And so it impacts people's ability to find community. If you don't feel like you can go out, or it impacts your career, what if you're supposed to go to all these networking events and you're really struggling in your addiction? Like, how do you go to the Chamber of Commerce networking event, which has wine? The giveaway at the end is wine. It's sponsored by the winery, because like in upstate New York, we have tons of wineries, or the microbrewery. Like, you got to make a living. So if you can create an environment that is safe for people by being out about your own struggles, I think that's, it's just a gift to the people around you.
Oh, so much. So much of what you said there. You know, I go to a lot of networking events. I go to a lot of big fundraisers, and the number of wine baskets they've put together, which is great. Clearly, there's a market for that. But what, you know, what about the alternative? I'd love to support this silent auction. You know, which item is great for the sober person, right? Or the number of events where you show up and they give you 2 drink tickets, you know, and I happen to not usually drink soda, or in Iowa we call it pop. You know, I don't usually drink.
Oh,
pop,
you're so over the pop I've line.
Got, yeah, yeah.
I lived in the West Coast for a while, and it was pop. I lived in Oregon, and it was pop. And then I moved back east, and it's soda. So it's a weird American divide.
You know, I try to be polite and use soda when I'm talking to a larger audience.
I mean, if only it's all pop, of America's divisions. If that was like America's only division, it'd be really great right now. If it's just pop versus soda, that would be so good.
Right. Right. But I mean, if you're paying for entry to this event, you want to have a great time. And what if they just had one alternative on the menu for the drink ticket, right? And if nothing else, it feels like a great value to me. But some of that stuff is just, it's just really low hanging fruit for sure. And we try to now be intentional about that at our events. You know, organizations have gotten really good about asking about dietary restrictions for good reason. The market is there. People can have severe allergies. But there's almost this sort of blatant disregard for addiction and mental well-being when we could easily have one great NA option at any large event, right? We can provide gluten-free dinners and peanut-free this, and that's awesome. Let's have one NA option.
Yeah, it is really telling when you frame it up that way, right? Like, it's actually so much harder to do something gluten-free than to just have one NA beer, one thing that's not just seltzer with a lime, which was my go-to for 1,000 years, and like still is. I like seltzer, but it's so much harder to do those other things than to just go to your drink vendor and say, you know, just order the NA Guinness for people.
Right. Right. Heineken Zero. It's a, you know, there's some really great now 0% alcohol, you know, IPAs and all this craft beer. And it's, they have all these options. That would be icing on the cake. It'd be bells and whistles. I'm just saying, like, one standard Busch Zero, right? Heineken Zero kind of thing. Yeah, exactly. Even to have that is always, I always am like, oh, wow, when they have that. And that's pretty low hanging fruit, I think.
I mean, part of it feels like, you know, I'm old enough to remember the transition with smoking, right? Like, when I was in high school and college and going out to see music in bars, I guess more in college than high school because I wasn't 21, but, you know, they were full of smoke and it was terrible. I had a coat. I had like the club coat because it was going to come back smelling terrible. And that, you know, there was that shift. And in that moment when that happened, there was like a lot of uproar about bars and restaurants really worrying that they were going to have some impact. And they really didn't, because I think it actually drew more people in to go to a show or sit in a restaurant where they didn't have to be around smoke. So I wonder,
yeah, absolutely,
are we at the front end of alcohol, like the younger, and you know, you can speak to your younger employees too, they seem less interested in alcohol, and not in a way of saying I choose sobriety, but it's just not something that they're that interested in.
I absolutely agree. I do see that in this next generation. And then in the sort of the teen generation, you know, the data is pretty clear that alcohol is much less of an issue today with, say, that high school, college demographic, less of an issue than it was, say, maybe in our generation. But of course, what they're facing are the e-cigarettes and now THC, and some of those things are on a much faster rise for them rather than alcohol. And so, you know, but the data is pretty clear that this youngest generation that's kind of in their teens and 20s, that alcohol abuse is nowhere near the same levels as it was with our generation. So yes, as a business owner, I imagine there would be a lot of runway there. And to hear your friend talk about the 600% growth, I see and feel that organically. I never quite know if it's because the people I associate with now are less likely to be drinkers because my life has changed so much, or if it's a bigger indication that, you know, society at large is maybe not consuming alcohol, or at least being more mindful about being sober curious and those kind of things.
Yeah. Can we touch back to sort of the suicide thing? Are you okay with that?
Yes.
So
yes,
I imagine your youngest probably doesn't know about that, but have you had that conversation with your older kids? Do they sort of know that place you got?
Yeah, they do.
I mean, they're going to now, I guess, if they listen to this, but.
Right. Yeah. No, today they are 18 and 15. And that I first started being open about that sentiment, I had that conversation in 2021. So it was only, you know, 3 years ago, which is, again, right before I got sober, a big catalyst for getting sober for sure. So I have talked to them about that and the power that alcohol had on me and how I really felt that sense of not having control and feeling hopeless. And it's hard to describe even to myself because I do have a really privileged, beautiful life in a lot of ways. And I remember at the time talking to my therapist and saying, I don't feel justified in saying this, in being feeling so hopeless, depressed, suicidal, because I know on a relative scale, I don't have it that bad. And yet here I am, and this is how I feel. And he would always say, well, pain is not relative and, you know, let's work on this. But to even try to describe it to others now, even to describe it to myself, is hard to understand how I was in that space. And I truly was blind to the role alcohol was playing in my life. I really thought life is just so hard, I just can't do it. And it didn't occur to me that, oh, I'm taking this substance into my body every day that's a known depressant. Maybe it's playing a role on me feeling depressed. I couldn't make that correlation. It's like a leap, impossible right. leap for me to
Shocker.
Make.
Shocker.
Yeah. Shocker, this depressant is making me feel depressed. Because when I talk about suicidal ideation and depression, I have this sort of sunny, optimistic disposition. I was born with it. I have it. That's just how it is. I don't take credit for it. We have some attributes that are sort of innate. I didn't have this lifelong struggle of, you know, clinical depression. I didn't have a diagnosis of clinical depression. So that is a real thing. That's not my understanding of the experience that I had. So I'm not a specialist in talking about depression. I can only say that I felt dark and hopeless in this hole that I couldn't get out of. I couldn't find a path forward. And I felt like it was, I just wanted to escape. And I just didn't make that correlation for about a year that alcohol was an integral part of that.
Did they give you a new list with that one, like, taken off? Do you get an amended list?
I know. That's a great idea.
You should ask for the new list. Can I please have a new list with only 9 items?
Yeah. How many of these things have I checked off the list now? I mean, to be fair, it was late 2020. It was a hard time for everyone. Everyone probably had a list.
Yeah.
I wanted to be like, listen here, kids. I have a list of 10 ways, 10 things you could do to help me, right? This is hard for a mom right now. Hard for a parent. Hard for everyone.
I guess I have my own list, right? Like, things that trigger me. Like, there's a holdover from those single parent years where, like, money stuff just can, like, make me so stressed out because it was so stressful back then that, you know, it's not like a healthy thing, but it's a thing. And I'm like, right, I, like, gotta constantly sort of work on, you know, my stuff, or I gotta just, you know, make sure I'm doing the things that keep me healthy so I don't. And I don't ever even think about alcohol. I mean, my whole, you know, world and household, we had a sober wedding. And someone's like, really? You're going to have a sober wedding? I'm like, yeah. A, it was like just all our family and close friends. But, you know, the foundation of our relationship comes out of sobriety. So, like, why would we possibly serve alcohol at our wedding? Also, like, someone I know, the woman who cuts my hair, is talking about the cost of her upcoming wedding. I'm like, that is insane. What you're going to pay for your wedding with its 3 bars. That's just bananas to me.
Right. So that people can have, you know, what, loosen up and have a good time. And and then all the chaos that we know ensues at those events. When
we had no chaos at our wedding. We had accordion, but course. No chaos.
Which is, that's amazing. Yeah. You know, I have a lot of that. I'm tempted to have that insecurity or fear about financial security, because as you said, when you're a single parent, it's you. That's it. There's no safety net beyond you. So what if I, not just what if I get, you know, lose my job? What if I get hurt, or, you know, all those things? So that fear could certainly take over if you let it. I think part of what sobriety has also taught me is living in the present. And when I was drinking alcohol, I inherently was never fully present. And so now I really tried that. It kind of goes in with that mindfulness, a daily meditation of really trying to live into being present. And it helps us not be so afraid of tomorrow. Be conscientious, be wise as we can and with planning, but not so afraid of the unknown, and have faith that if something difficult happens in my life, I will have the tools and resources to deal with it. And that being the case, how shall we proceed? That is truly my motto since I got sober. That being the case, how shall I proceed? And not having to live in the fear of that. So being fully present is a big part of my sobriety, and something I don't think I was very often prior to that.
And I think that's what we owe to other people, right? Our kids, our partners, the people we work with, is showing up and being present. Like, we might not be 100%. We're all doing our best, but you got to be present and you got to show up. And that's just, you feel it when people do that for you. I mean, you told this story that I saw somewhere about this coach when you're at, like, basketball camp, like, you know, singling you out because, you know, you're an amputee and there you are at basketball camp. And it was just this really moving story about being seen by somebody.
Yeah. And you think someone who is under the influence can't really bring that, right? They can't bring that presence. And that's something that was really lost on me in my parenting, that well, in all of my lanes as I was drinking every day, that I didn't realize the impact on other people in that way. I thought, as long as I'm physically doing the thing, I'm physically doing my job and I'm physically here with my kids, they're not going hungry, they're getting to practices, I'm volunteering. It didn't occur to me to stop and think, but am I present? Is my mind and heart and emotions right here with them in this moment? And people can feel when it's not, and your kids can feel when it's not. And so I think when I was so blindsided about that being on their list, I kind of had this like, how did they know? And I'm not drinking too much. And what impact does it even have on them anyway? I'm still here. I'm not, you know, I'm not abusive. I'm not arrested. I'm not like, why would it matter? And now, of course, in retrospect, I'm like, my gosh, you know, those poor kids, because of course it mattered, because I wasn't quite fully there. I was softening the edges of everything. And what a regret I have.
Yeah. And then, you know, my almost 21-year-old, he sort of remembers. And I was really, I never was a drunk. I was a medicinal is how I describe it, right? Is like, well, 2-3 glasses of wine. Well, that's all. Now I feel that's good. I'm better.
Right.
All right. I can make my way through my evening now. But the 16-year-old, because she was so little when I stopped, doesn't really remember. And of course, my stepkids, they only know me as this person. And so, you know, it's interesting to sort of reboot with parenting. And you have like olders and younger, so you probably get this a little bit. You're like, oh, right, I learned a lot in that first run. And now I'm sort of giving it this other go here. And I definitely feel like I have a lot more perspective this time around. Also, parenting partnered. I think it's interesting for my oldest now to, I think it's sometimes hard for them because they're seeing the best version of me as a parent, because I'm in this deep, loving relationship. I don't, and they're not resentful of it, but I think sometimes they do feel like, oh man, like it was hard. It was like hard for dad those years to be, you know, present, or I worked a lot. I would freelance a lot and just, always have a side gig, always have an escape plan. I even said that to a boss once. He was difficult. And that when we actually, I don't work for him anymore, but we have a great relationship. And he was just this sort of power boss, if you know what I mean. And I just was like, I leaned back in the chair and I was like, man, this just isn't going to work for me. And I said, you need to know about me that if I feel like this is going south, I'm going to create an exit strategy and I'll find another job. And it actually fundamentally changed my work relationship with him. I think he was like the classic, you know, he was probably in his 60s at that time, the old sort of corporate structure guy, the boss is the boss and you got to do what I say and all that. And office culture doesn't really matter. But I don't think he was used to getting pushed back. But it was also a moment for me because I had come to that job out of a very difficult corporate environment, like shareholder traded company, which I'll never go back to. As I had this realization that that company, they're talking about utilization numbers. And I was like, oh, that's a person. A utilization number to you is actually a human being with a family. They're not a dollar sign. And that, you know, I'm just this old punk guy and that did not sort of square well with me. And so I came out of that and I was like, you know what? I'm not doing that again. Like I'm going to stand my own ground. And I even, who was I saying this to? Maybe it was my oldest son. It was someone who was younger. I said, oh, you figure out along the way, a job interview is actually a two-sided thing. Right. Yes. You are interviewing your prospective employer. You know, so many years I just remember it always felt like I was being interrogated and I brought my little like earnest little questions to show I prepared. But I wasn't actually trying to figure out if it was a good match for me. And I just had my 2-year review where I am. And, you know, we're talking and I said, this feels like a really good fit, right, for me. And I think it's a good fit for you. And I was like, I think this is where I'm going to roll till I retire. And that's the first time I felt that way in a long time is that, oh, right, the balance works for me in this setting. And I think it works for my employer.
Well, that's really a gift that you have found that. And I think that's something a lot of people seek at work, you know, maybe to be able to show up authentically or to feel invested in that level of commitment. I think that ties in nicely to something we talked a little bit about, like that fear of financial insecurity and the fear of talking openly about being sober, right? Because what kind of label or stigma, you know, I've had people ask, people who love me a lot, and say, aren't you worried, or maybe you should be cautious about talking about this as much as you do, because what if there's some great future opportunity and they see that you used to drink? What if there's some great future thing and they hold it against you? And I think to your point about feeling like it's a great fit, for me, a great fit is being showing up authentically, getting to be genuinely Beth. And I think people that get to know me and the role that I'm in, my board today shows a lot of trust. They like Beth. They like the results we have, the leadership style, the way that's working. And but if I can't show up authentically, Beth, I'm not sure that's the right fit for me. And so it's part of the fabric of the DNA of who I am now. And so I guess if some future opportunity, if it holds me back from that, then that opportunity is not for me. Period. You know? Yeah. And so I try not to, that's a fear that I've let go of. Okay. And that's not for me then.
Yeah. Right before I got this job, I had posted, I guess it would have been my 12th sober anniversary, put up on LinkedIn. And I've had this moment, I'm like, oh my God, I'm in the middle of like, I've interviewed there once, I'm going to go back. And what if this blows it up? And then I was like, well, if that blows it up, I don't want to work there. Right. If that's actually a thing, I don't want to work there. And like, you know, and I'm heavily tattooed, and like being at a place that trusts me to know when to roll my sleeves down, you know, like I'm 53. I know how to dress for client facing stuff, or I'm not going to show up, you know, at the hospital gala and like, you know, a tank top or something. Like I got it. Right. I got the suit. Which I had to get taken out after COVID. I'm not going to lie. I actually had that job interview and I was like, oh my God, these pants do not fit the way they used to fit. Because I was also running a lot before COVID, which was, it was healthy, but unhealthy, I think, for me. Like it became the gym and that stuff became a little obsessive replacement. I mean, It's certainly a better choice, but you know, sort of balance and moderation in all things. Matters.
Right. And is it still a form of escape? I mean, that's what it comes down to, right? Like exercise or the gym is not inherently, you know, bad. It's, are you escaping any level of your life, or is there any part of your life or yourself that you're not confronting by obsessing over this new thing? And I think that maybe foundationally is a good reflection point when we navigate new obsessions. And maybe an obsession could easily be a relationship, a person, right? That's a common one as people are going through early sobriety, like find a new distraction. And
right.
You're really doing the full work.
Yeah. Are you doing the work, or is that just the new dopamine hit, which is really in some ways worse, because then you're just sort of using people and you will tell yourself all day that you are not doing that, that you're clear in your intentions and all that. But I don't think in my experience, my personal experience, that I was probably 100% the person I wanted to be in those situations.
Sure.
You know, which was a very hard reckoning, I feel like, as the father of daughters, and like what example am I setting? Is this like, who I want to be? And the answer is no, like absolutely no. But, and that's it's heavy when you have to look inward and be like, I got some stuff to work on, because I am not the person I want to be. I am not the person my kids deserve. That is like, or they give you a list. It is not.
Exactly.
That's hard. I mean, I had a therapist and she pushed me on my crap, because I would come in and I would joke around. She's like, we're not doing that. We're not doing the like funny guy thing. Like I needed to be pushed on my stuff. And that's how you get better. And if it's a program or what it is, you have to like, cause you see people, I see people who, yeah, they stopped doing the thing, but they haven't dealt with the underlying reasons behind the thing. So likely they've just found some more socially acceptable version. that's feeding whatever the beast is underneath it, but they're not actually trying to like slay the dragon or whatever. These metaphors are terrible, but.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Have you identified, have you worked on your sense of self and your self-worth and how you show up in the world and boundaries and triggers and trauma and childhood trauma? And have you worked on all of that and have a clear understanding of your sense of self and how you navigate in the world? And we can tell ourselves we have, but it does take a lot of work. And I used to sort of irritate me when people would say that. I'd read these books about sobriety and doing the work and doing the work. I'm like, I don't know. What does that even mean?
Yeah.
You know? And then at once, I think, you know, once you're doing the work, because it's deep self-reflection and accountability, full accountability for the course of our lives and the actions we take. And that's really hard.
Yeah, I think that's an incredible place to end. So thank you very much. Thanks for listening. Sober Dad Crew is a DIY project by Stephen Kimball, who writes, edits, and produces the show. To support the show, please review it where you listen to podcasts or visit soberdadcrew.com to buy some merchandise or make a donation.